The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia author series. My name is Lori Jones, an alumna of the Philadelphia High School for Girls and Spelman College, and a proud library cardholder. Our guest this evening has made an indelible mark on the arts and culture scene in New York City and the nation. A transformational figure, under her leadership, the Studio Museum of Harlem grew into a vibrant institution key to Harlem's economic revitalization. She led NYU's famed Tisch School of the Arts for decades, overseeing its continued production of trailblazers in film, theater, and interactive media, as well as its innovation redefining the study of art, as evidenced by the development of new academic programs such as the NYU Game Center and the Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Program. At President Barack Obama's request, she served as vice chair of the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities, reaffirming the arts as one of the ingredients essential to effective public school education. 3 years ago, she stepped in and stepped up to lead one of our nation's most prestigious institutions, Spelman College, a historically Black liberal arts college for women. There, she recently secured a multi-million dollar investment to fund, no surprise, art history and curatorial studies, undoubtedly ensuring diversity and inclusion in that critical area for decades. Her latest book, which she will share with us this evening, reveals her passion and tenacity as a scholar and art lover. In it, she expertly provides us with the historical context of and personal insight into the life and work of one of America's most renowned 20th century artists. It is indeed an honor and a treat for us to welcome one of our own, a graduate of the Philadelphia High School for Girls, class 208, right? And Swarthmore College, back home with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Mary Schmidt Campbell.
Thank you very much, Lori. It's great to be here at the Philadelphia Free Library. When I was in high school at Girls High, where are my Girls High classmates? Hi! Good to see you. I used to love to come here. In fact, I was just telling, reminding my husband that my sister could always get out of the house by saying, I'm going to take Mary to the library, and she'd come and drop me off, and then she'd have a good time someplace else. But Philadelphia is a very special place for me because also this is where I met my husband of 50 years now, Dr. George Campbell. He went to Central High School. And I'm delighted to be here now as Spelman's president, and I understand there might be some Spelmanites in the, yay, yes, good, right. See my Spelman sisters. So this Labor Day, the book An American Odyssey was published. And when I tell people that I've written a book on Romery Bearden, I get two questions almost always. The first question is, who's Romery Bearden? And the second question is, why did you want to write a book about him? And I've thought about that question many, many times, and what I'd like to do this evening is to give you the many reasons why I decided to write a book about Romery Bearden and what his art has to say, not only about Black culture, but about American culture in general. So when I was a graduate student at Syracuse, my thesis advisor gave me this catalog. It's the catalog of Romery Bearden's retrospective exhibition that was at the Museum of Modern Art in the 1970s. And when I opened up this catalog, I looked at the work in it, and I fell completely in love with it. And she said, you must go see the work of this artist. And what I learned later is that around the 1970s, someone handed this exact same catalog to the playwright August Wilson. And this is before Wilson had written any of his plays, and Wilson says that he opened up this book, and the entire vision for his 10-play cycle came to him after looking at this work. And this is what Wilson had to say. What I saw was Black life presented on its own terms, with all its richness and fullness, in a language made attendant to everyday life, ennobled it, affirmed its value, and exalted its presence. And as Wilson turned the pages of that catalog, he would have seen regal figures. He would have seen everyday life like this Palm Sunday processional that was represented as if it were something out of the sixth century. Something out of the sixth century, like this Byzantine processional. He would have seen a representation of African-American beauty that was unabashed and celebratory. And he would have seen images that were incredibly complex, that spoke to identity not being something singular, but something that was layered, something that was even perhaps contradictory, something that was jangling, perhaps. So let me read to you what I say about this particular collage. This is one of the collages that was in the retrospective exhibition, and it's one of the earliest collages that Bearden exhibited publicly in May of 1964. The setting Bearden has constructed, like a hastily assembled puzzle, is a clash of incongruities. On the left, you can see over here, a black and white news clipping of a white man in a business suit is plastered to the wall. On the right wall is what looks like a yearbook photograph of a young black woman. A white Santa grins cheerfully from a television screen. Bearden has made use of a snippet of a reproduction of a painting, a formal chandelier. You can see that up at the top, very top of the image. To define its improbable presence as light fixture in the down at the heels interior. He represents the food of the meal as magazine clippings and the jarring combination of white woman, black woman, African artifact. You can see that in the face of the woman. Television image, photos of a suited white man and a young black woman, snippets of painting all jammed into a cramped space, create the explosiveness of cultural collision. Who was this artist who could assemble so many disparate elements in his work into a unified visual text? It was clear that in anchoring his vision in black culture, he was also making a larger statement about culture in general. So that was one of the things that I wanted to explore. Who was he? Who was this artist? Where was he born? What was his life like? What were his sources of inspiration? What did he have to say about black culture? What did he have to say about culture in general? So let's take a look at Bearden's life, some biographical facts of his life, before we take a look, a more extended look at his artwork. So the book is divided, by the way, into three parts. The first part is called Terms of the Debate, because one of the things that I wanted to demonstrate in this book is that Bearden grew up in an era where visual images were actually debating with each other, and I'll show you what I mean. So here's a photograph of the young Bearden. You can see him in the arms of he's a little boy, yes, in his little dress with his little patent leather shoes. And he's being held by his great-grandfather, H.B. Kennedy. Standing next to H.B. is his great-grandmother, Rosa, and his grandmother, Catherine. They had been slaves. So he grew up in the household of emancipated slaves. And one of the things that's most remarkable about his upbringing is that he grew up in a household in which the people in his household had completely reinvented themselves. H.B. was extremely successful. He was a businessman. He worked for the railroad. He owned property, several homes. He rented out some of his homes. He had a grocery store. He was an extremely successful citizen of Charlotte. And Bearden was born in his home in 1911. Now, this photograph is not just a family photograph. This photograph becomes a document of their status as citizens. And so let me read you, to you what I say about this photograph and how this photograph compares with some other images that were beginning to proliferate at this time about these new black citizens. Mundane as this photograph might seem, it was a vital record of the family's status at a time when visual images were fast asserting power and influence. Their photograph captures a successful post-Reconstruction black family that had hoisted themselves up from slavery and were filling their home with successive generations of black citizens, contributing members to Charlotte's thriving economy. Just as the Kennedys and others were enjoying the fruits of their new entitlements, there was a backlash, turn-of-the-century vitriol, that fueled verbal and written debates about the millions of newly enfranchised black citizens. So images like the cartoon by Thomas Nast that was on the cover of Harper's Weekly. Harper's Weekly at one point had a circulation that was in the hundreds of thousands. And this image is an image that basically communicates that African Americans are not fit to hold public office. The increasing use of lithographs, wood engravings, and etchings, as well as photography, enabled the wide circulation of cruel and demeaning parodies and satires of everything families like the Kennedys were striving to achieve. In the years after slavery, pictures of Sambos, lusty bucks, buffoonish coons, solicitous grinning mammies, and as Bearden himself would write as an adult, head in the watermelon caricatures proliferated. Bearden's family had much to lose or gain from the debate. Advertisements for everyday products, sheet music, theater, the new medium of moving pictures and photographs, especially the macabre practice of photographing the lynching of black citizens, attempted to reduce the industriousness of families like the Kennedys and Bearden's to allegories of sloth, or worse, a threat to the moral order. American visual politics was a battlefield. Representation was a matter of life and death, not just art. So that's one of the tenets of the book, is that, in fact, visual images are not just decorative. Visual images have a purpose. Visual images can actually be weaponized. So this is Bearden's family on the right. About 1915, 1916, they migrated to Harlem. You can see Bearden in the middle. He's got a sort of puff of hair standing between, again, his great-grandfather and his great-grandmother, and that's his mother and father standing just above him. They migrated to Harlem, and again, the photograph documents what they believed to be their identities as upright, respectable citizens. In the meantime, Courier and Ives, which was a very popular printmaking company at the time, they sold tens of thousands of prints, found that many of their most popular prints were prints that made fun of black families. Most striking, about the time that the Bearden's were moving to Harlem, was the emergence of cinema. And of course, the first blockbuster that we had in our country was Birth of a Nation. I don't know how many of you saw Black Klansman, the Spike Lee film. You would have seen images from Birth of a Nation a couple of times during the movie. But of course, the point here is that the movie was used, in fact, to glorify the Ku Klux Klan, and again, to portray African Americans as not fit for citizenship. So again, visual images used as part of a battle, an argument, a debate. And the most horrible aspect of our history as a country was not only lynching, which was bad enough, but in fact the practice of photographing the act of lynching, selling the photographs as postcards, either mailing them through the mail or selling them post facto after the fact. There was also reference to that in Black Klansmen, if you recall. So, constructing visual images then became very important in our country, in our culture, in the culture of African Americans. And Bearden had the great good fortune to move with his parents to Harlem, which is the Black cultural capital of the world, and that was a place where visual culture flourished. It flourished in almost every aspect of life that you could imagine. This is one of the first protests that was conducted by African Americans on Fifth Avenue. It was called the Silent Protest. And when James Weldon Johnson gave instructions for the protesters, he told them all to show up in white dresses, the men to wear suits and boaters, straw boaters, and they walked down the street silently to the sound of muffled drums. And James Weldon Johnson had said that it looked like a black and white movie that was unspooling before their eyes, because he knew that in order to capture the attention of the public, he had to create a dynamic visual spectacle. This is what Bearden grew up watching. He grew up watching people like Marcus Garvey, who had these wonderful parades throughout Harlem. It was part of the United Negro Improvement Association to take, inviting African Americans to go back to Africa. But to do that, to encourage membership, he had these great parades. There were parades with the Elks and the Masons. And in Harlem in those days, there were great big wide boulevards and beautiful architectural wonders like Stanford White's townhouses and Edward Mowbray's townhouses. So Bearden had this incredible experience as a young person of being immersed in this visual culture uptown. Film in the Black community was thriving. Oscar Michaud made dozens of films, and Bearden's mother, you can see her name, Bessie Bearden, had a bit part in one of Oscar Michaud's films from 1921. The film is lost now, but we do have the playbill, and so we know that she had a part in the Gunsalus mystery. Whoops. And then there was his mother. His mother became one of the principal members of the Harlem social and political scene. She was started out as a ticket taker at the Lafayette, then she became a correspondent for the with the Chicago Defender. She became the chairman of the school board. She was the first woman to become a school board chair, and ultimately the deputy tax collector. But the most important thing that she did, she opened up her home to all of the writers, the musicians, the actors in Harlem of the day. And Bearden has written and said that he would come home and there would be Fats Waller sitting in his living room, or Duke Ellington, or Langston Hughes, who had brought Garcia Lorca into his mother's parlor. So in fact, through her, he had this incredibly rich understanding of the intellectual and artistic potential of Black culture. And Bessie Bearden was also an incredible political activist, because in the early 20th century, African Americans were mostly Republicans. It's hard to imagine, isn't that? That's what, wow. But it was the party of Lincoln. But with the advent of the New Deal and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she became one of the activist women who went all over the state of New York to convince African Americans to switch their party loyalty from Republican to Democrat. So she had real power. He was in a household of real power, real creativity, real intellectual conversation, and an environment that was incredibly rich. He spent a great deal, he spent several years of his early childhood in Pittsburgh. This is an article he wrote later as an adult about the steel-making environment of Pittsburgh, a very different working-class environment from the more kind of glamorous aspect of Harlem. But it gave him a depth of understanding of Black life. As a result of working, he lived with his grandparents in Pittsburgh in a boarding house. And there would be as many as 20 or 30 men who had left their families down south and who had come up north to work the steel mills, get enough money to send back home. And he understood how grueling and challenging that life was for African Americans. By the time he graduated from high school in 1929, the Depression had hit. So he was a very privileged young man to be able to be entering college in 1929. He started out at Lincoln University. He only stayed there for a year. He actually went to three different colleges. He went to Lincoln for a year, then he went to Boston University for a couple of years, played baseball at Boston University, and was very good at it. In fact, was recruited for professional baseball, but turned it down because he would have had to pass for white, right? Because there weren't Black baseball players back then. And finally, he graduated from New York University in 1934. But even in 1929, you can see on the masthead of their Lincoln News staff, he's listed as cartoonist. So he's begun to show very early on an interest in cartooning, in drawing, not yet fine arts, but certainly in drawing. And he is a cartoonist at Lincoln, at Boston University, and at New York University. He graduates from New York University in 1934, so we're now in the heart of the Depression. He takes a job as a caseworker, and this is what I find phenomenal. For the next 30 years, he has a full-time job. And not a job where you sit at your desk. He has a job as a caseworker. So in the middle of the Depression, he has to go into apartments. He has to help people who are about to be evicted. He has to help people in situations of intense overcrowding. He has to help people who are unemployed. The unemployment rate in Harlem during the Depression was 50%. It was 33% throughout the country, but it was 50% in Harlem. He had to help people who were dealing with incredible health issues every day, 5 days a week. So whatever art he did at the end of the day. He would come home, get out of his work clothes, and go to work. So that was his life. But again, he was coming back to a Harlem that was still filled with incredible creativity because of the New Deal. Because the New Deal provided artists with the capacity to be supported. So an artist like Aaron Douglas could flourish. And this is a magnificent, epic, large, monumental piece of work that Douglas did, which was hanging in what we call the Schomburg Center. Augusta Savage had an active studio in Harlem, and she would invite young artists like Romy Bearden and Norman Lewis and others to come in and work in her studio as she worked. And Bearden said it was the first time he had ever seen a real artist at work in her studio. Of course, there was Jacob Lawrence, who was Bearden's peer. And they actually had a studio for a short time in the same building. And Lawrence, this is Lawrence from Lawrence's Migration series, which became really the first sort of nationally, he became the first really nationally known African-American artist and very successful with this this series. But he was Bearden's peer. So he was surrounded by artists, by poets, by photographers. And even though it was in the heart of the Depression, it was still a very rich environment for him, visually. Theater was flourishing in Harlem. Even before the Depression, there were shows like Shuffle Along that started in Harlem and went to Broadway. This is a production of Macbeth that was directed by Orson Welles in Harlem under the Federal Theater Program. that was going during the 1930s. And then, of course, there was Harlem nightlife. Because of Prohibition, if you wanted a drink, you had to come uptown and get it illegally at one of the joints. And this is a map that was done by the cartoonist E. Sims Campbell that sort of maps out all the places that you could go. Connie's Inn, Cotton Club, the Savoy, Small's, Paradise. Some of them were segregated, and some of them up until a certain time were for whites only. And then after a certain time, many of them would open up to anybody who wanted to come. And some of them were exclusively for blacks only. So it did bear some of the Jim Crow segregation that was rampant elsewhere in the country, but still Harlem was a place that was attracting people from all over the world. We know now that Henri Matisse came to Harlem. And if you haven't seen the show Posing Modernity in New York City, that tracks the attraction between European modernists and particularly the African-American female body, please go see that show. But one of the discoveries was that Matisse actually used to roam the streets of Harlem and visit the cabarets. So in fact, Bearden had a chance to visit the Cotton Club, to see musicians like Cab Calloway, to watch the women dancers and choreographers. We know that they had an international impact. We know that, for example, there were male impersonators. We know that a dancer like Josephine Baker became internationally renowned. And here is Matisse's cutout, La Négresse, which bears a striking resemblance to the Josephine Baker. So we know that he had, through the Depression, through these years, there was a visual culture, despite the fact that there were all these demeaning caricatures and parodies that were happening in the mainstream community. Bearden had a visual culture in Harlem that was incredibly rich. And he doesn't use it at first, but it's something that kind of lodges in him and becomes almost like part of his DNA, and he will call on that much later, and I'll show you examples of that much later in his more mature work. In 1934, having just about to graduate from college, Bearden is definitely an artist now who connects himself as a race man. And he says in an article that he wrote for Opportunity, if it is the race question, the social struggle, or whatever else needs expression, it is to that the artist must surrender himself. An intense, eager devotion to present everyday life, to study it, to help relieve it, this is the calling of the Negro artist. And so he very much identifies himself as a Negro artist, and in that role, he does cartoons for the Baltimore Afro-American. I learned in the course of doing this research that the Baltimore Afro-American had a readership that exceeded the readership of the New York Times in its day. Now, that's different from a circulation. Why? Because one person would get the newspaper and pass it on to the next one, to the next one, and to the next one, and the Pullman porters would pull the newspapers up into their trains, and they would distribute them throughout the trains. So, in fact, Bearden was a cartoonist for several years for this paper, so it means that his cartoons got wide readership, and he pulled no punches. He's representing the Ku Klux Klan, and you'll see on the sleeve of the Klan a swastika. And he's making the analogy between the domestic terrorism of the Klan and what is being identified as the rise of fascism in Europe. He did this for several years and then turned to painting. And his paintings are very serious. The palette is very muted. They're what I would call social justice paintings. And that was a style that was very popular during the WPA era. When he had his first show in 1941, the paintings that he exhibited at that time were all in that style. The figures are very wooden, the scenes are very bleak, and he's clearly an artist who wants to communicate and convey the condition, the social conditions of African American life. This probably is one of his most famous paintings of that period. Fortune magazine published it in 1942. It's called Factory Workers, and it was published along with an article that talked about unemployment among African Americans. And then the war came, World War II came. Bearden enlisted. Shortly after he enlisted, his mother died, very suddenly. And this is a woman who had been not only the center of his life, but the center of life in Harlem. Shortly before she died, there was a major riot in Harlem, 1943. There had actually had been one in 1935. So all this wonderful environment in Harlem was also beginning to come undone. As the Depression wore on, conditions worsened for African Americans. Many artists started to leave Harlem. Prohibition was repealed. So the reason for coming up to the nightlife in Harlem went away. And Harlem began to deteriorate very quickly. And Bearden went into an army that was segregated. The army during World War II was completely segregated. And he has written many letters to convey his sense of desolation and isolation during the years that he was in the army. And during those years, his art began to change. He begins to go into the phase which I call the Negro artist dilemma. And what do I mean by that? He begins to ask himself, well, am I an artist? Or am I a black artist? Well, if I'm a black person, does that mean I have to be labeled only as a black artist? Can I just be an artist? And he begins to question whether or not race and the representation of race in the life of black people is something that he should champion as an artist. And his art changes radically. And the first series that he paints that is a radical departure from this is a series called The Passion of Christ. And it's a series that's based on the Passion of Christ. And this is He is Arisen. And he paints begins to work on that while he's in the army. A very important gallerist sees this and exhibits it in Washington, D.C. And a very important gallery dealer in New York City sees it and brings him into his gallery. And Bearden, for the next 20 years, is an abstract painter. For the next 20 years. So he underwent a complete transformation from the work that he had done when he first started out as an artist. He began to paint series that were based on the Bible, on literature, on classical literature. This one is based on Garcia Lorca's elegy for a fallen bullfighter. He paints a series based on Rabelais, a series based on the Iliad. And you can begin to see that he begins to pattern his compositions after classical Renaissance paintings. And he begins an intense period of studying painting. He would copy paintings, one painting after another. He said he was too shy to go into the Met and copy them in the museum, but he would photograph them, and he'd put them up on his easel, and he would copy them, one after another. And this intense period lasted for at least two decades. But what I found was interesting is while he was being an abstract artist, while he's studying Western painting so closely, he's still nagged by this whole issue of representation, of how we're represented. And he writes this article in 1946, and he says, "It is the privilege of the oppressor to depict the oppressed. Consequently, the picture of the Negro was that of a shiftless, dim-witted buffoon. This concept was one of the means of keeping the Negro in his dark corner. And if you read that article, what he says is that the way we have been represented blinds people from seeing the truth. They can't even see black people because black people have been so demeaned by these representations. And he says that black artists have a difficult time seeing also. And so he decides that the way for him to deal with this is to be not primarily a Negro artist, but an artist. And he holds fast to that belief for about 20 years. This is the last series that he would paint in that period, around 1948. It was a series based on the Iliad. And then he gets dropped by his New York gallery. Because his New York gallery thinks that paintings like this look too much like Picasso's cubism. And they say that he's retrogressive because, of course, abstract expressionism is beginning to develop. And so American artists are painting on a much larger scale. They're not using figures. They're not having a foreground and a background. They're using this all-over approach to painting. And then all of a sudden, Bearden finds himself without his New York gallery, and he finds himself now with Harlem at a point where Harlem has dissipated as an artistic community. And he begins to enter, during the 1950s, he begins to enter into a phase that becomes a real serious sort of coming to terms with himself as an artist and as a creative person. And so he goes to Paris on the GI Bill. He leaves the United States. He gets a leave of absence from his job as a caseworker, and he goes to Paris. This is, in order to be eligible for the GI Bill, you have to go to school. So he actually had to enroll. He had to enroll at the Sorbonne, and he had to go to a couple of classes, but of course they don't take attendance, right? So he would show up in one or two classes, but he really had a good time in Paris. And he totally and completely fell in love with Paris. Because it was a great time to be in Paris. He would say that he would go and listen to James Baldwin read excerpts from his first novel. Or he'd walk down the streets and he would hear music playing, and it would be Sidney Bechet. Or he would run into Al Murray, who was a wonderful novelist and writer. And he could go and visit Brancusi in his studio. He could go visit Pablo Picasso or Leger. He had a wonderful freedom. He felt for the first time that he didn't have to think about whether he was black or an artist. But he could just be who he wanted to be. And he stayed in Paris for about 5 months. He came back and didn't paint very much. He actually decided to take up, he left Paris, he came back, he decided not to go back to painting, but to take up songwriting, because he wanted to raise money to get himself back to Paris. So, and he actually published some songs. Billy Eckstein sang one of his songs, Sea Breeze. And I think Seagram's used it as one of their jingles or songs. But he did have some success as a songwriter, but it didn't go well for him. And he has said on many occasions that one day he just stopped in the middle of the street, sat down in front of a fire hydrant, wrapped his arms around it, and just blew a fuse. And he had a complete and total breakdown. It took him a while to come back to painting. And even as he came back to painting, he comes back, this is mid-1950s, he's coming back, it's kind of almost as if he's kind of searching for an image. He still has his studio on 125th Street. It's above the Apollo Theater. These are two photographs. This is a 1952 photographs that were taken by Sam Shaw. One of them is on the cover of the book. He held sessions in his studio for artists to work from live models. But what I found fascinating is how he was trying to kind of keep himself together and keep himself motivated as an artist. This is one of the beautiful sketches that he did during the 1950s of a woman, an incredible woman by the name of Joan Sandler, and he gave it to her many years later, as a gift. But he was doing sketches, he was doing songwriting, he was holding these sessions in his studio, and then he met this woman, Nanette Rohan. Nanette Rohan was one of eight in her family, and the family came from St. Martin, and she met Bearden at a fundraiser, and they married in 1954. And she recognized right away that he was wasting his time as a songwriter. He was wasting his time in all the other things that he was doing, and he had to get back to work. She was a model. What you can see her in the Vaseline ad, you can see her, I think that's Colgate toothpaste ad there. But she was quite extraordinary, quite beautiful, but quite a creative person herself, and she saw in her husband someone whose creative spirit needed to be harnessed back in and focused. And she actually arranged for him to get one of his early exhibitions in 1955. And between 1955 and early 1960s, he was painting these big, beautiful, gorgeous abstract canvases with no figurative images. Later, some figurative images came in him. He began to experiment with collage. Here's another example of some of his work. There was an exhibit at the Neuberger Museum that exhibited many of the paintings that he did during these periods, but this was a really fertile period for him returning to painting, really getting back to composition, to color, to just understanding the texture of the paint and returning to the world of being a painter. You can see this is one of Bearden's paintings that was in the pre-inaugural suite of John F. Kennedy. So he was beginning to have some real success with these large abstract oils. And then he changed once again. In 1963, A. Philip Randolph gave him a call and said, "You know, we're organizing a march down here in Washington. And we'd love to have some artists come and be part of the march." And in the course of trying to organize some artists, Bearden and a few other of his colleagues got together and formed an organization called Spiral. And it was a collective of black artists. And it was the first time, this is 1963, summer of 1963, it was the first time in almost 20 years they had made an effort to gather together a group of black artists. They were mostly men. There was one woman, Emma Amos, an incredible artist who joined them. But in the course of their conversation, trying to figure out what does it mean to be an artist, to be a black artist, to be a black artist at this time in the civil rights movement when all this churn and change and was taking place, Bearden came up with the idea that as a group, they should do collage. And he tried to get the group to work on a group piece. And they were having none of it. So he went back and did his own collage. Now, I showed you this painting, this collage at the beginning, and I just want to make the observation that this piece, this work, is really not much bigger than this. It's a little bigger, but it's a very small piece. And the Congress on Racial Equality was having a fundraiser, and they said, "We need some pieces from artists so that we can raise money." And this is the piece that Bearden put together for CORE. That was in May of 1964. And then in October of 1964, using this same principle, and again, this is a relatively small piece called The Street. He's still clipping and cutting bits and pieces from magazines and newspapers and putting them together and capturing really the energy and kind of defiance and assertiveness of the era. And he decides to photograph them in black and white and blow them up. And this became, he was doing this all on his own. He was still painting his, you know, his big oils. And his dealer came and saw this and said, "This is your work. This is your work." And so they put together an entire exhibition of his projections. And if you I wish I could have been in that room, but I was still at Girls High, I think. But you can get a feel from the photograph of how the energy that came from this. And one of the most striking things about these projections as you look at them is that you're not just looking at the figures in this piece. They are looking at you. And this sense of his coming to grips with the very act of seeing becomes part of what he begins to include in his artwork. This notion that the act of seeing itself is not passive. It has an element of engagement, in this case, perhaps even indictment. And so that all of a sudden he has put his images in a different relationship with their viewer. And you can see that in particular in this piece, which is just called Untitled. Now this is 1964. There are two figures up on the roof. Actually, Bearden and Al Murray used to stand on the roof of Lenox Terrace a lot and look down. But there are two figures sitting up on the roof on the right-hand side, the Statue of Liberty, and he has planes going into buildings. This is in 1964. And a sense of divisiveness and anger and clash. And Bearden at this point is really capturing, channeling much of the change in perception and understanding of identity and culture that was taking place at that time. This is an untitled piece of about 1964. Magazines and periodicals would often ask him to do their cover because they felt as though he got something about the city. This is cover of Time magazine in 1968, and Lindsay was in big trouble in New York City, and he just pictures the entire city falling down around Lindsay with a frieze of students above it. It was during these strikes, during the school strikes in New York, and also the strikes of the sanitation workers and I don't know who all else was on strike, but New York was pretty chaotic in 1968. As you can see, New York, the breakdown of a city. He began to do large public murals. He was commissioned first to do a mural in Times Square in the 1970s, then one for the city of Berkeley. This one was for a hospital in the Bronx. That did not go well. The hospital for which he made the mural, a group of politicians rejected it. They thought that it was too, they used the word obscene, because he had put in images of nudes and their other images of lovemaking and what have you. But he does a number of public works. He does a work here in Philadelphia in 1976, the Cinque mural that's at the African-American Museum. He does a piece in Atlanta. The building was demolished, so the piece was demolished. In Baltimore, he does a beautiful piece for the subway, as was the case for Pittsburgh. So his public art, he becomes a much more visible public artist during this period. He becomes a collaborator. One of the things that I found that was truly extraordinary was the number of artists with whom he collaborated. This is with Diane McIntyre, who is a dancer and choreographer. Bearden collaborated with Alvin Ailey, with the playwright Ed Bullins, with the poet Jane Cortez, with the poet Derek Walcott, with Intozake Shange. Magnificent collaborations. He was an intensely collaborative artist in the last decades of his life. So what I'm going to show you to close this up are just some samples of the work that he did subsequent to the projections. The projections were the first introduction of his collages. They were in 1964, but after that, he didn't photograph his collages in black and white. And he stuck primarily to color. And I'm just going to show you the images and the sources, because here you can see the deep richness that August Wilson was talking about. Bearden draws on all kinds of sources, on religion, on ritual. He draws on the evenings that he spent at the cabaret scene. He has done series on the blues and on the history of black music. He has drawn on black folklore. This is a conjure woman. Conjure woman is a very frequent figure in his work. He says that a conjure woman is powerful. She can change her figure. She can make people do things. I always thought that was because he had a lot of strong women around him, like his mother and his great-grandmother and his grandmother and his wife. But he has these images of powerful images of women of magic. Classical images. He draws on classical literature. The Odyssey series is a series that he comes back to over and over and over again. This image of Circe is from the Odyssey. And here he has blended the image of the Odyssey with the image of a conjure woman. Just the simple everyday life of a woman working in her garden making the magic. This is called Model Sweet's Magic Garden. Oops. And one element that I confronted in the book was the fact that although August Wilson speaks of Bearden's images being noble and dignified and all of that, throughout his collages, there is a very strong motif of what I call just the raunchy and the racy. And it seems to me that part of the liberation that he experienced when he started working into collages is he just decided, I'm going to make the images that I want to make. And this is a... one of the images that he had in one of his autobiographical series. So I'm going to end with a look at one of the few paintings that Bearden has identified as a self-portrait. He has maybe two or three images that he said are self-portraits, but this is very formally part of an autobiographical series, part two, the 30s, and it's Artists with Painting and Model. You recall I showed you the photographs from the 1950s of Bearden in his studio with Model. So he has chosen as his self-portrait, the location is his studio, and that is him almost faceless. If you get up very, very close to this painting, you can see that there's a sort of bare sketches. And this actually is quite a large painting, 44 by 56. So this is a collage. And this really is kind of a much more monumental size. And he has on his easel a painting of his from 1941. And it's as if he is saying that as an artist, he has spent a lifetime being in conversation with his own art. And in that conversation, he has been in conversation with his art, and he has been in conversation with art of other ages and other people, even as he is using the live model empirically. And if you can see right down at the feet of the easel, he has sketches to the left of the sketch, you can barely see, it's kind of like a Benin head, and you can see a pencil and scraps of paper. It's as if he wants you to see all of the elements that make up his art. So here's a close-up of the scrap of paper, and you can see that he has related the African, the Benin mask, to the figure of the woman whom he's sketching. Here's that sketch that you saw earlier of Joan Sandler, and you can see it's almost identical to the sketch that's up in the right-hand corner. The Benin mask that was on that sketch is something he clearly has been looking at, the symmetry and balance and elegance of African antiquity, and he referenced that as one of his sources. And you can see just below his elbow, just if you look behind his elbow, there is a little bit and piece of Duccio. He references the time that he spent studying Western European painting as well. And so he's bringing all of those elements into his studio and understanding that as he's having this conversation with his art, he is free to choose whatever it is he wants to choose for it. And this is a photograph of me with hair. And that's Mr. Bearden. And I just put that up because he was, for all of his, by the time that he died in 1988, he had won every single possible award you can imagine. But he always had time for young artists, for young curators, scholars, anybody. He went out of his way to help anybody. It was as if he didn't want anyone to have the same kind of isolation that he once felt as an artist. So for all of what he did as an artist, he was also an incredibly generous mentor to the young artists and scholars who were around him. I used to think I was so special, right? Until I met about two dozen people for whom he had done exactly the same, been very supportive. So I want to end with some thoughts from the book about what Bearden's work means nowadays. And this comes from the epilogue in the book. The proliferation of visual imagery has accelerated exponentially since Bearden's death. And with that growth, black image makers have grown in prominence exponentially, not only in the fine arts, but also in film and television. On television, audience and critical powerhouses like the shows of Shonda Rhimes, Ava DuVernay, and Donald Glover present dramatic and comedic images of black life through complex characters and original, sophisticated storylines. Filmmakers, fiction, and documentary have created unsentimental portrayals of the state of American culture through a black lens. Spike Lee, Malcolm Lee, Stanley Nelson, Raoul Peck, Ava DuVernay, Dee Reese, Carl Franklin, Barry Jenkins, Jordan Peele, and Ryan Coogler are just a few of the filmmakers who have sustained careers that have built audiences for sophisticated image making. Ralph Ellison's observations about Bearden applies to their images as well. They have destroyed cliched images. Yet, Wakanda notwithstanding, there is not triumph in these successes, only the knowledge that the battle continues. Black Lives Matter has supplanted the chance of We Shall Overcome in the 1960s and Power to the People in the 1970s. Mass incarceration has replaced Jim Crow as the number one civil rights issue. The urgency of image making remains. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.